for 58 years, thanks to listeners just like you. Coming up in a moment, Vantage Point with Professor Ron Daniels.
Good morning. This is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels, President of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer at York College, City University of New York. Welcome you to this, well, it's a week before Juneteenth, June 12th edition of Vantage Point on WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with ycradio.org. That is the York College radio station. And what a wonderful show we have today. Very informative. Let me just first say that it's so important to continue to support WBAI, Pledge Drive or no Pledge Drive. Best way to do that is to become a WBAI buddy. I push this every week. I only do that because it's important. That's why I say it every week. You can become a WBAI buddy very easily. What a WBAI buddy is a sustaining contributor, which means you give something every month. You can do as little as $10 per month if you can afford it, and we hope you can on your credit card or through your checking or savings account. You can do it, and you get goodies with that as well. But the real goodie is you get WBAI. You help to sustain it and can proudly say so. And so we want you to become a WBAI buddy. Again, I am one and have been one for several months now. And, of course, you get a tote bag and other kinds of goodies to go with it. And there's some access to retailers as well to give you some discounts. So you get a whole lot, you know, for becoming your WBAI buddy. But the biggest thing you get is WBAI itself. So go to give2wbai.org, give2wbai.org, and sign up right now to become a WBAI buddy. Quickly, I trust that the Puerto Rican parade went well yesterday. I haven't had a chance to read all the reports. I understand that Oscar Lopez Rivera received a hero's welcome in the parade. I guess some people dissented a little bit, but basically he was welcomed tumultuously in the parade, and I had the honor of being in his presence at 1199 SEIU, their penthouse on 42nd Street, on this last Saturday, and a great event that was took place. The council president, Melissa Mark Vigarita, and the new congressman from Harlem was there, and a number of other people, faith leaders, other political prisoners. It was an incredible event. So I think it is a mark of the collective triumph of the efforts of the people that he is free. And he did it on his own terms. He did not compromise. Could have been out earlier, actually, had he agreed to renounce violence and some other kinds of things. Also very encouraging, a number of people, once I was announced as one of the guests in the house, came up to say they listened to Vantage Point. So we hope that you will continue to do so. Today's show, we're going to spend a good chunk of time talking about the assault on Afro descendants in Colombia and South America. Then we go to Newark, New Jersey, with our dear friend Larry Hamm, with the People's Organization for Progress, that's planning a major march and rally for reparations on June 25th. And we'll conclude with Peter Goldberg telling us about bail bond reform. That's right. There's a way in which people are now looking at the bail bond system as being a racket, a system that is counterproductive and really leads to people being incarcerated much longer than they should be, or in many instances, even when they're innocent and have not even had an opportunity to have their day in court. So that's our show for today. Our last segment will be devoted to your calls, and we'll give you an opportunity to react to anything that you have heard in the first three major segments of the show today. We begin by introducing Yvette Modestine. Yvette Modestine is a major figure in the Afro-descendant movement in South America, in Central and South America. Her organization does incredible work organizing women in particular, but Afro-descendants in general. She hails from Panama, and in the interest of disclosure, is a member of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century Board and on the National African American Reparations Commission. Sister Yvette Modestine, welcome to Vantage Point.
Morning, Dr. Daniels. Glad to join you again today.
Great. And from all the way from Colombia, on the ground, is Esther Ojalari. Esther was a participant, panelist in the State of the Black World Conference held in Newark, supported by WBAI, just by the way, and on the panel dealing with the global reparations struggle from Colombia, and subsequently extended an invitation to members of the National African American Reparations Commission, including myself, to attend, and also James Early, Danny Glover, and whatever, a reparations workshop in Colombia, which I attended and learned a great deal. And she is an incredible organizer. And she joins us all the way from Colombia. Esther, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Well, today we want to spend time really educating some of our audience. WBAI has a very sophisticated audience, so they may be somewhat familiar with these issues. But as educated as I am, and these issues, I must say, coming to Colombia firsthand and listening there during the reparations summit was an incredible eye-opener, exhilarating but also very painful in terms of the plight, if you will, of Afro-descendants. So we really want to spend some time today telling our audience about that, but then also talking about the current crises that is unfolding. But I want to do it in a way that gives people adequate background. So, Esther, first of all, just give us a little bit about your own background in terms of the work that you do, where you went to school, just a little bit of your own background.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, I was born in the UK to African parents. My father is South African and my mother Nigerian. And I studied sociology at the London School of Economics in London and then went on to do a master's in human rights. And I'm now working on a PhD in human rights, and I came to Colombia several years ago to do field research for that PhD, and I'm working with Afro-descendant organizations here in Buenaventura on the Pacific coast of Colombia. I'm particularly working with Proceso de Comunidades Negras, which is a Black communities process, who have been fundamental in defending the human rights and territorial rights, particularly of Black communities in the country.
So now, Esther, give us some historical background, because I was stunned, even though my sister Yvette Modestine has been educating me for years, but we were in Cali for this conference, and somebody said, there's a million Black people in Cali. I said, whoa, what, a million? Mm-hmm. And then it just... I mean, the number of Afro descendants in Colombia in and of itself is just an amazing fact. I talked to some people the other day, just yesterday, about it, and they had no clue about this. So tell us, give us some background on, in terms of the historical context of how Afro descendants came to Colombia, some nature of what the population looks like, where they're situated. Spend a few minutes just giving us some background in that regard.
Okay, well, I mean, the transatlantic slave trade, which trafficked Africans to the Americas, brought significant numbers of African, particularly West African people, to the South American continent. And Cartagena on the Caribbean coast of Colombia was one of the main entry points, slave ports or ports for enslaved, for bringing enslaved Africans into the continent. So a huge number of Africans were brought straight into Colombia. Some of them were then taken to other parts of the continent or other parts of South America. But many were enslaved in Colombia throughout the country. There were implantations in domestic servitude, in mining as well. And following emancipation, many Afro-Colombian communities were formed throughout the country, but particularly in the Pacific region. So the largest populations of Afro-descendants now are in the West Coast Pacific region of Colombia. And Cali, which is the capital city, which you mentioned, which is where we held the reparations conference, is often cited as the city with the largest number of Afro-descendant people in the whole continent of South America after Salvador de Bahia in Brazil. That's debatable because there are huge numbers of Afro-descendant people in other cities in Colombia as well, particularly in Bogota, and often due to underrepresentation in official statistics, that they're not always visible in terms of those statistics. But yeah, Cali has at least a population of a million Afro-descendant people.
What's the total Afro-descendant population?
Well, according to the last official census of 2015, the entire population is about 10% of the population of the country. That figure is hugely disputed, and actually most more recent studies and research cite the population as more like 25-26% of the population of Colombia.
But what does that translate to in terms of a number?
Yeah.
Yvette, sorry.
No, I just wanted to add to put in context that number and how it fits into the larger number that we're seeing, 150 million plus, 200 million plus of people of African descent in our region. To then put that number into where Colombia fits, you know, it's Brazil and then Colombia, and then Ecuador is soon behind. But then if you put it into the larger context of the world, it's Brazil, Colombia, and the U.S. So that's to show you the population of Colombia's Afro-descendant community in the larger context, the global context.
Absolutely.
So Esther, we're talking
and
about
the current population of Colombia is around 48 million. So if we're talking about 25%, it's around 12 million people.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to get that out. So now continue in terms of the formation of these Afro-descendant communities. Where did they land? How did they form? And that is, I guess, a sort of a context for them also being under siege.
Yeah, absolutely. So, during the period of enslavement and shortly after, many enslaved Africans escaped slavery and formed what are called palenques or marine communities around the country in very isolated areas where they're able to defend their freedom. And those communities remained very isolated for generations. The areas in which the majority of Afro-descendant communities live now are areas with highly rich in natural resources such as gold, other precious stones, wood. Many communities live along the river region of the Pacific. And so while for many years the government neglected and abandoned those communities in terms of infrastructure and investment, particularly in the context of kind of, you know, neoliberal policies emerging in the air more recently, the state has turned its attention to those regions, is now very, very interested in developing those regions in terms of of getting hold of those natural resources.
Now, Yvette, you sort of anticipated what I wanted to ask, and that was to sort of give us a sense of where Colombia fits in terms of the Afro-descendant populations within the region. But let's, you having stated that to some degree, the question that you have been on for many, many years is stressing the importance of people being aware of it and the struggles of Afro-descendants to maintain their identity and to defend a sense of self-determination. Would you comment on that, please?
And I want to start first with connecting a little bit, you know, as you asked me from a global perspective to what Esther is saying, and why I think all the listeners need to understand that what is happening in Colombia is about all of us. It's about all people of African descent, wherever we're standing, because of the common history. When Esther speaks of the Palenques and the Maroon communities in Colombia, that also, as a Panamanian, connects the Panama story, because we were once part of Colombia. And there was a period in our region in the late, mid 1500s that it was 5-1 of people of African descent in the region. So to know that these Maroon communities, these Palenque communities, were communities where Africans lived and progressed and were able to survive. And those are the lands, no matter where we're at, may it be Buenaventura in Colombia, Bocas del Toro, Colón in Panama, Puerto Rico, Santo Domingo, you know, Nicaragua, Puerto Cabeza, Bluefields, any country where the Black communities landed, where they were surrounded by natural resources, are under attack right now. So we need to understand that piece and how it connects, because it also speaks to the displacement issues of Black communities in the U.S., because we are living in areas in the U.S. where there is some resources and folks are now being displaced for those resources to be taken over by those who do not look like us. And the thing that makes Buenaventura and what Esther, and I first have to say, Esteb, you know, for your amazing work, just overall, but more for the last 22 plus days with the strike, shout out to you, hats off to you, to Francia Marquez, Jimena Sanchez from WOLA, Charo, Mina Rojas, Marino Cordova, and many others. And most importantly today, I stand with Afro-Colombian leaders who have been assassinated and are under attack. Most recently, Bernardo Cuero Bravo, who was assassinated last week due to these fights. So it's one of those things, Dr. D, when I have been speaking about this in the IBW space, in the NARC space, in our ARAC regional council space, is that for many of us, this is a do or die situation. And what we have seen in the last 22 plus days in Buenaventura is that it is a do or die situation, because folks have been arrested and have been assassinated. And it's a direct link to the U.S. It's linked directly to the Fair Trade Act with the U.S. So it's not about the U.S. thinking that this has nothing to do with them. The U.S. is very involved in some of the company agreements and bank agreements that the leaders in these areas were speaking up against. And then the racism. The racism is at the core of this, as Esther was speaking around the population, but these are heavily populated Afro-Colombian communities who have been fighting for issues around the issues of poverty and violence in these areas and have been ignored.
Talk to me about, and one of the things I've been hearing for quite a long time is, and I get the notes from Gemini, and I get them from you, Yvette, and, you know, this leader killed, that leader killed, and whatever. Talk to us about either you, Esther, or Yvette, about how these Afro-descendant communities also were caught in the crossfire of the Civil War. That also seemed to have been another very painful experience. It seems like there, you had that going on, as well as corporate interests and other interests simultaneously moving in to try to seize the land. And then I want to get to the specifics of what just recently happened.
Okay.
Okay.
Esther, you
want to
go first?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Esther.
Okay. Yeah, no, absolutely. So Afro-descendant and indigenous communities are some of the worst affected by the armed conflict in Colombia, largely because the conflict took place in many of the regions which are ancestral territories of the communities. So often community leaders who were resisting violence and resisting invasion of their communities by the different and many factions involved in the armed conflict would get identified and targeted for that resistance work that they're doing. As Yvette mentioned, one community leader was recently killed for ongoing work. Bernardo, but this is there is a long history of Afro-descendant and indigenous community leaders being targeted and assassinated for their resistance work, and often being accused of being part of different factions by opposing factions, and which also resulted in that. The peace process itself. Communities had to fight extremely hard to be involved or to be included in the peace dialogues and to be recognized as collective victims of the armed conflict. And through a lot of struggle, they were able to have to gain a seat at the negotiating table and to submit demands for recognition within the agreements that were made between the government and the FARC. And that resulted in the inclusion of an ethnic chapter, el capítulo étnico, in the peace agreement, which was basically a document to which guarantees safeguards for Afro-descendant and indigenous communities within the context of the implementation of the peace process and the peace agreement. Because reading the negotiations and the agreements that were made, communities were very well aware of the risks that some of those agreements could have caused for their communities and for their territories, even in the post-conflict era. So in terms of, regulation of land, land titles, opening up new spaces in which development projects could then be implemented in the post-conflict era could have caused further displacement, further problems for the communities. So that ethnic chapter was really a way of safeguarding their rights in the post-conflict era. And the chapter is only 3.5 pages of a 300-page document. Mm-hmm. And those 3.5 pages were really fought hard for to the very last moment of the dialogues. And it's through the inter-ethnic collaboration between indigenous and Afro-descendant communities, as well as very important pressure from outside of Colombia as well, from allies, particularly in the U.S., that they were able to get those agreements included in the peace agreement. And that's now really the main focus of the communities in terms of implementing peace in the country.
And just to add to that is that Colombia has one of the highest displaced communities. Afro-Colombians and indigenous Colombians are the most displaced communities in the world because of this conflict. So as we talk about displacement, and how it connects to our work, Dr. Daniels, with around the issue of reparations and displacement and land, is to put that in into context. And also to highlight, piggybacking off of Esther, is that, there were 3 pages, there's this massive agreement, but since that agreement, Afro-Colombian leaders have continued to be killed.
Mm. Now, Esther, talk to us about this most recent rebellion, frankly, insurrection, where people have stood up and that we were glad to hear about. IBW has issued a statement about it and whatnot.
Yeah.
So tell us, what was the impetus for it? What was the genesis for it? How did it unfold? Just tell us about that.
Okay, well, the civic strikes that took place this May and June, there were several strikes going on around the country, but in terms of the Afro-Colombian movement, civic strikes took place in the Chocó region and in the city of Buenaventura, which is located in the Valle del Cauca department. These strikes were not the first time they've happened. They're a response to the failure of implementation of agreements made in previous strikes. But this most recent strikes, particularly in Buenaventura, which I can speak about more because I was here in the city. The Buenaventura strike began on the 16th of May. It lasted 22 days, and in those 22 days, no businesses were running, or very few businesses were running, no transport. There was very limited movement throughout the city, and the community came together to demand that the national government would respond to the urgent situation facing Buenaventura. Buenaventura is a city of over 400,000 people. It's got some of the lowest social indicators in the country in terms of access to education, access to health services, access to justice, housing. Most people don't have running water, or we don't have 24-hour running water in the city. Sewage, many of the, about only 60% of the city is covered by a sewage system. So there are really, really low standards of living in the city. And this is a city which is home to the country's main international port. And through that international port every year pass, billions of dollars worth of cargo being imported and exported. But as the port was privatized in 1994, most of the profits from that port don't come to the city. They go to private business. So the movement in Buenaventura, which has been going for many, many years through various different local organizations, community-based organizations, has long been calling for investment in infrastructure, in basic services, and also to address the terrible issues of violence, which the city has also been victim of. But recognizing that those issues that are faced are very much related to the existence of this port and the inequality that it causes. So the recent strikes called on the government to declare a state of emergency and allocate funds to address these issues. There was 22 days of striking. There were negotiations with a government delegation, which went on for a long time, and the community really came together and took to the streets, marched, chanted, called, singed, held cultural events in an effort to be heard, in an effort for their demands to be recognized by the government. The part of the strikes involved these meeting points along the main road in Buenaventura, which lead towards the port, and that involved blocking some of the roads, which prevented cargo lorries or cargo trucks from coming in and out of the port, and thus almost bringing to a halt this machine that's usually functioning, bringing in profit. So the government responded incredibly violently. The ESMAD, which is like the anti-riot squad, was brought into the city and to violently repress the strikes. So the protesters were attacked with tear gas day after day and night after night to clear the way for these trucks to come in and out of the port. But there were also attacks in communities as well. There was a Human Rights Commission set up to monitor what was going on during this by the community during the strike. And there are countless testimonies and stories of people who ended up in hospital, children who've ended up in hospital, people who were attacked not only with tear gas but also with bullets as well. So it was a really a violent response from the state to this what was a peaceful process calling for nothing more than the fulfillment of very, very basic fundamental human rights to water, to education, to employment, to safe housing. And the community held out despite the circumstances, held out for 22 days of strikes while a committee of for the strike negotiated with the government and was eventually able to, while the government didn't declare the state of emergency, which was the original original demand, they have agreed to allocate a special heritage fund to Buenaventura to address the most urgent issues. And part of that fund will come from revenue generated by the port. But, you know, as I mentioned, this is not the first strike of this of its kind, and it's not the first time that promises have been made by the state. So the agreement was signed with the idea that, or with the condition that, you know, if these agreements aren't fulfilled within a certain amount of time, the community will strike again because the situation is urgent. The situation is urgent.
Okay, well, that's a good point to take. We have to take a little break here, but I wanted to give all of that background. We're going to come back and talk about that because it seems, and we've been this all over the world, economic sanctions work when you can strike at the heart of capitalism, strike at the heart of resources and profit, then all of a sudden there's a different tune that comes from those who are in power. Again, our guests are Yvette Modestine, who is coming to us by way of Boston, and all the way from Colombia is Esther Olajalari, who's doing much major work on the ground and is telling us firsthand what transpired in terms of this amazing strike for 22 days. We're going to take a break here, come back, and finish our conversation with them, particularly in terms of what this means, what kind of support can be forthcoming. And also, is there the prospect of a National Reparations Commission being formed in Colombia? We'll be right back after we take this break.
Hi. My name is Michael G. Haskins, and I'm one of the hosts of The Morning Show, which airs Monday through Friday, 6 to 8 a.m. on this station. WBAI is listener-supported, commercial-free, resistance radio, challenging norms and defying them. Let's break down what that means. It means that no clandestine corporate entity tells me how to do my show. You better believe that. It means that you, the listener, and the diverse WBAI community have a voice which reverberates across the tri-state area. You drive this station, so fuel us. Donate by visiting give2wbai.org or pledge right now from your smartphone by texting the letters WBAI to 41444. And thank you for your support.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Hi, this is Virginia White of Earth, Wind, and Fire, and you're listening to The Sweet Spot on WBAI.
Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m., Baby K from The Sweet Spot teams up with DJ Spinna in a tribute to the mighty force of musical ascension known as Earth, Wind, and Fire. We'll be featuring an interview we did with bassist Verdine White and also chopping it up with Spinna as he plays some of his favorite Earth, Wind, and Fire tracks. That's The Sweet Spot, Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m., only on WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored community radio.
This is Brenna Keeley from Make Music New York, inviting WBAI listeners to participate in the 11th annual Make Music New York celebration on Wednesday, June 21st. Every year in the summer solstice, we fill all five boroughs with free outdoor concerts, and we want you to join the fun. For more information on how to participate either as a performer or as a venue, go to makemusicny.org. And don't forget to tune in Fridays at 2 for Making Music with Jordan McLean here on 99.5 WBAI and WBAI.org.
Okay, we're back. And again, a very, very, to me, important segment of our show today. I really, really wanted to educate our audience on what is going on in Colombia, but also the broader question of what's happening with Afro descendants throughout the hemisphere, which is an issue that I've been being educated on for several years now by Yvette Modestine and people like Waldo by Stewart, who is here, and his lovely partner who has worked on these issues as well, Esmeralda Brown, and many, many others, including, well, I'll stop there, but the many, many people who have really drawn our attention to the incredible importance of focusing on the totality of the African population in the region and its interconnectivity, really, to the African population here in the United States. So Yvette Modestine joins us from Boston. Esther Ojulari joins us from Colombia. And we're sort of having a conversation, really, about the background, the history, and this Afro-descended population under assault. And Esther has just talked about this agreement that was arrived at after 22 days, and some anxiety about the government's promises. And Esther, I must say that when I was there in Cali at the conference, that's one of the things I took a note about, that there seems to be on paper many, many agreements that at different levels that speak to recognizing Afro descendants, recognizing their rights and this and that. But there seems to be a gap between that, you know, in the legislative policy arena and what is actually happening on the ground.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's often discussed and pointed out. In terms of human rights in Colombia in general, is that Colombia has an extremely wide and far-reaching normative framework on human rights, on ethno-territorial rights. It was pioneering in on legislation on displacement. But in terms of implementation, there are many barriers, and that's really where the struggle on the ground comes in.
And I would suspect that there's barriers is when these interests collide with corporate interests, the rights of these of the interest of people who really want to seize the land. I guess that would you say that that's the major contradiction?
Absolutely, and that's the major struggle as well. And that's why I mean the strike that took place in Buenaventura is a really very explicit example of that, because you can, you know, the port is a very visible representation of those private interests and corporate interests, but the same struggles are going on all over the country. Yvette mentioned recently, Yvette mentioned at the beginning of the interview, our sister Francia Marquez, who is from a community in northern Cauca in Colombia, and she and her community have been fighting international mining companies who are given given mining titles to mine in their rivers, which are polluting the environment, are displacing communities, and are displacing traditional livelihoods of communities as well. So it's and again, promises were made, agreements were made. Francia and her colleagues carried out a march of women from Cauca to Bogota in 2014. Where they occupied, or they declared a nationalist a general assembly in the offices of the Ministry of Interior until an agreement would be reached, until the government would agree to remove these mining equipment and company from their rivers. And agreements were made, but then the struggle comes to actually having those agreements implemented, and so the struggle continues to go on.
And I just want to add to what Esther is saying, Dr. Daniels, because I think this is key before we end the show, is to make the connection to the U.S. And to other places, but, you know, to make the deeper connection to how this is seen in the U.S. and how the U.S. is involved in this. It's through the Fair Trade Act. And also, you know, I would ask for folks listening to call their congressmen and find out the roles that some of our communities, some of our states are playing in some of the displacement and the violation of human rights of Afro-Colombians, because many of the companies are U.S.-based companies. One of the things that we found out during the strike was a lot of the ammunition and the stuff used against Afro-Colombians during the strikes may have been U.S. Bought. So, you know, there is some direct linking that we need to keep in mind. And also to make those congressional calls, you know, there was a congressional letter that was started by Representative Ellison that many signed, but that it's about also the U.S. monitoring the implementation of this agreement, because some of this agreement has to do with U.S. companies, and that the U.S. Uphold some of those agreements and the implementation of those agreements to the people of to the Afro-Colombian communities.
So I know that the Washington Office on Latin America has been doing spearheading a lot of the work vis-a-vis, you know, trying to get the word out and whatever. We and IBW is trying to expand it, frankly, beyond just the Congress to organizations like the NACP, the National Action Network, Rainbow Push Coalition, and other organizations, some faith leaders, to sort of broaden the outreach, because sometimes we need them to put pressure on the Congress even. But who within the Congressional Black Caucus, for example, is there a person? You said Ellison wrote this most recent letter, but is there a person who's been kind of spearheading and is on watch in relationship to Colombia?
There's a few, but I think for this current sort of with the strike and sort of the implementation, this was pushed forward by Representative Ellison, but also John Lewis signed on the letter. McGovern signed on the letter. I think one of someone that has been in the IBW space and the NARC space, Representative Clark, who we have a good relationship with, did not sign the letter. So I would ask that IBW members and NARC members call Representative Clark and give her, you know, she's supported us on many other issues, and to have her understand why this was important for her to sign off on.
What about Congressman Gregory Meeks? Did he sign on?
Yes, Meeks signed on. Yes.
Great.
Yes. So you know, and I could send the list of all those who signed on so that we can have folks know who the representatives are that signed on and who we still need to put in some calls to. But I think just because the agreement was signed is not sort of this doesn't end the situation. You know, as Chato, Sister Chato sent us a detailed email, you know, there's still, we need to uphold this. We need to uphold that there's proper investigation, proper implementation of the money and the distribution of the money that's coming into the ports and the percentage that was said to be put into the community for the infrastructure for water and health and basic sanitation services in the area. So it's not about, okay, the strike is done and we won. It's the strike is done. Let's make sure that this doesn't happen again.
The other thing I would ask, Yvette, is because we will certainly share that on next week's show, the list of those who've signed, those who've not signed on. But also, it would be helpful, and I don't know, again, unfortunately, IBW doesn't have the resources. But we need to find someone who can also research these corporations, because, you know, you can't hit them all, at least from my perspective, all at once. But we may be able to identify a particular corporation that we can target and begin to put some pressure on, and in so doing, highlight and educate around it. So that would be a useful thing for us to collectively think about as we try.
We have that, Dr. Daniels. Some of the leaders have already started to put that together.
Good.
But one of the companies that comes straight to mind right now is Coca-Cola.
Ah, okay. All right. I remember back in the day we used to say Coke sweetens apartheid. Maybe it's again to
yes.
hit them again. But that's what back in the Free South Africa movement, that was one of the slogans, Coke sweetens apartheid. And Coke is getting itself in some pretty deep trouble.
And they're
in other
still involved
the
on the ground with this.
Right, so we'll do that. Well, we're really out of time, but one quick question for Esther before we depart. And Esther, thank you so much for joining us. It's valuable to have your voice on the ground contributing to the program, and we look forward to seeing you. We're looking at potentially a reparations gathering in New Orleans in November, and we'll be giving you more information about that. But just quickly, how are the conversations going in relationship to the prospect of forming a National Reparations Commission in Columbia?
Yes. So at the reparations conference we had in March, the idea on the table was to form a reparations commission. Currently, I mean, with so many things going on, communities are very, very focused on the implementation of the ethnic chapter and the peace accord. But the idea would definitely be to participate in the event that you've mentioned in New Orleans, so that we on some of the discussions that were had around reparations. It's just really important to highlight here that the reparations movement in Colombia is very focused on drawing relations between the violations of human rights carried out against Afro-descendant people in the context of the armed conflict and then the historical context of enslavement and colonialism, and understanding those violations as a continuum throughout history. So that reparations process would really draw on the peace process, but also understanding that the conflict has only heightened the historic injustice that the Afro-descendant people have faced. And if there's just 1 minute, just to say that in all of these processes, the international solidarity is absolutely fundamental. And I think one of the reasons why one of the very, very important fundamental elements of the strike that just happened was the international support and solidarity shown from organizations in the U.S., such as WALA, as you mentioned, the Black Alliance for Peace, the Afro-Colombian Solidarity Network. We had letters and petitions from the U.K., from the UNISON Union. And so I think that all of that, as well as putting pressure on politicians here, also helped to visibilize what was going on, because often the national media doesn't show the real picture. And so that's also absolutely fundamental.
Okay, well, thank you so much. We and IBW certainly have pledged to do as much as we possibly can within the limits of our resources, and they are limited, but we're going to do the best we can. And I'm sure we at WBAI, through these kinds of programs, will continue to do likewise. So next week I'll give kind of a report back on the letter, who's on, who's not, some of the corporations, as a follow-up to this conversation. So, Esther, thanks much for taking time out of your schedule to join us today. The same to Yvette Modestine. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Well, to our listening audience, we'll have an opportunity for people to react at the bottom of the next hour at 11:30. I would simply say that the Montgomery bus boycott continues to come to mind. I'm a strong proponent of economic sanctions, and I think we in this country, as African Americans, people of African descent, are missing out by not picking a target. And I've talked to a lot of people, they want to boycott everything at all. That ain't working. But we need to flex our muscle around this now $1.5 trillion of economic resources that we have at our disposal, that if we were to use it properly, would choke a corporation or two corporations and send a message that we're serious, you know, about the plight we faced here in these United States of America. Well, the last discussion with Esther about the formation of a reparations commission in Colombia is a nice segue to our conversation with one of the great leaders of our area and in the country, and one of the great organizations in our area and in the country, the People's Organization for Progress, which is planning, in the midst of planning, a march and rally for reparations on June 25th. We are joined by Chairman Larry Hamm, the chairman of the People's Organization for Progress. Larry, sorry for being a little bit late, but welcome to Vantage Point.
No problem. I'm glad to be here. I'm honored to be on your show and with my friend of, oh, man, we're going to be on 50 years soon, Ron.
That's right.
Going back to Gary, 1972.
That's right. Yes, a long time. Long distance runners, I hope.
Well, when I say Gary, for the listeners, I'm referring to the famous historical National Black Political Convention that occurred in Gary, Indiana in March of 1972. And I think that's where you and I made first contact, and then we resumed contact after some years after that through the Rainbow Coalition and the Jackson Campaign and other efforts.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And let me just again thank you and the People's Organization for Progress for contributing to the enormous success of State of the Black World Conference 4, which we are still working on in terms of the follow-up. But let's get right to it.
It was a wonderful conference, and people are still talking about it.
Right. Well, we're still in the midst of doing the follow-up as well. But reparations is on the agenda of the, has always been on the agenda of People's Organization for Progress, but you're making an overt move on June 25th. Why the march for, or the march around reparations?
Well, Ron, you said it, Dr. Daniels, I should say, you said it correctly. When we founded the People's Organization for Progress in August of 1983, reparations was right at the top of our 10-point agenda of reforms that we were going to work on when we first formed the People's Organization for Progress. And we have had a reparations activity with our organization for almost every year since we were founded, and we're coming up on our 34th anniversary. We're having this march on June 24th in Newark, New Jersey, because we feel we need to draw attention that the, you know, Black people, we have to constantly fight to keep our issues in the forefront of public consciousness and to keep our issues in the center of the public square. And I've even noticed, even though police brutality continues to be an ongoing epidemic in the United States of America, even police brutality has kind of been pushed back by the media from the front pages the way it was, you know, in the aftermath of Michael Brown and Eric Garner and Sandra Bland and many others. So we have to work constantly to keep those issues that are critical to our community in the forefront of public consciousness. And this is why we are having our Reparations for African Americans March on Saturday, June 24th in Newark, New Jersey, beginning 12 noon at the Lincoln statue in front of the Essex County Courthouse at the intersection of West Market Street and Springfield Avenue. For those who use the GPS, you could put in the address 303 University Avenue. That's Essex County College right across the street from the Lincoln Monument. But we'll be starting there at 12 noon, and we plan to march throughout the center of downtown Newark. And after the march, we will have a major rally. And Dr. Daniels, I'm extending my personal invitation to you to be a speaker at the rally, if you haven't already received the communication, at the rally on Saturday, June 24th.
And that will take place at?
That will take place. The rally will begin at the Lincoln Monument at the intersection of West Market Street and Springfield Avenue in the heart of downtown Newark. And that's at 12 noon. And many people who attended the tremendous Million People's March Against Police Brutality, where that march started and ended is going to be where the Reparations March will also start and end on Saturday, June 24th. Everybody, please put that on your calendar. We need a massive turnout to let the nation know that reparations is important to us, and it's important for our generation to make a statement. And you know, Dr. Daniels, I always hear people say, when I start to talk about reparations, you know, especially not to activists, but when I talk to regular folks, they say, well, it'll never happen. Look, regardless of whether or not, first of all, if you don't believe it, it won't happen. We believe it will happen. But if you don't make the demand, it will never happen. What did Frederick Douglass say? He said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. And many, many people talk about the horrors of slavery and what our ancestors went through, and all of that is true. But if you really understand just just how horrific and just what a catastrophic crime against humanity slavery was, then you need to make the demand for reparations, because this country was built on labor stolen from African people, labor whose cost estimates are in the trillions of dollars. So we have to make this demand, and I challenge everybody in the WBAI listening audience to come out and march with us to demand reparations for African Americans in the 21st century.
All right, so again, we're starting and starting and ending at the Lincoln Monument. Now, let me also move, and I sent you an email about this, and I also saw Sister Ingrid Astley at the African parade, people of African descent parade,
yes,
a couple of weeks ago.
The African American Heritage Parade.
A couple of weeks ago.
Right.
I got a chance as I was hobbling back to my car because I've been having some.
Yeah, they told me you were there. I'm sorry, I missed you, but I was marching in the parade, so I really couldn't interact.
Yeah, well, actually, at the time the contingent, the pop contingent came by, I was actually talking to the mayor about follow up to the State of the Black World Conference, so I missed I missed most of the pop comrades because I was on the review stand and whatever. But one of the things, Larry, I wanted to talk about was the importance in this period of a focus on H.R. 40.
And that is the center. That is the centerpiece of our march on June 24th. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Good. And the reason why that's important is I just had a conversation the other day with members of NARC, National African American Reparations Commission, Conyers Office, representatives of Movement for Black Lives and whatever. And the effort is to try to make sure that as many people are signed on to H.R. 40 by September 22nd, 23rd, when the annual legislative conference takes place. And people should be aware, and I'm going to ask that you get sent a copy of it, that we have a new H.R. 40. The H.R. 40 is no longer just a study bill. The new bill, paraphrasing it, is entitled A Commission to study reparations proposals, which is different than simply studying whether we are entitled to and da-da-da-da-da.
Right.
This is now saying concretely we need to look at specific proposals for reparations. So it has now become a remedy bill, not just a study bill. So we really, the New Jersey delegation, I assume that Congressman Payne is on, but we should take nothing for granted, sort of looking at all and targeting that New Jersey delegation to encourage as many of them to sign on as possible would be a tangible, concrete objective. And, of course, it's an organizing tool. It's a way of educating people about reparations. And let me just finally say, reparations is in the air now in a way that I haven't seen, frankly, in a long time. There are just so many books being written, not just by that African scholars in and of itself is not sufficient, but there are more and more scholars coming to the forefront, you know, talking about the nature of capitalism and how it was built, as you said before, on the backs of enslavement, and more people in the faith community and others taking this not like a crazy idea, you know, like, well, something needs to happen in terms of redress. So this march is absolutely on target. It's absolutely on time. It always would have been on time, but there's a way in which things ripen at a certain moment. So we're now riding a wave. And particularly with the CARICOM nations coming out, all 15 of them demanding reparations. You just heard the conversation of what's happening in Colombia and, you know, people in Colombia now. So this is exploding all over the globe. So POP is on time as usual.
Yes. And I, Dr. Daniels, I read the materials that you sent me. And let me just say, for everyone who is listening to the radio right now, you need to call Congressman Donald Payne's office. Donald Payne Jr. is the congressman from the 10th Congressional District here in New Jersey. He is the only African-American member of the House of Representatives from New Jersey. New Jersey only has one black congressperson. We didn't even have our first black congressperson since the founding of the republic with the election of Congressman Donald Payne Sr. He was the first and only black member of the House of Representatives. So I'm urging everyone in the listening audience to call the office of Congressman Donald Payne Jr. and ask, because I don't think we're going to have to fight too hard on this. I think I know Congressman Payne Jr. We've talked. I think he can be easily convinced to become a co-sponsor of H.R. 40. Dr. Daniels, he is not, to my knowledge, he is not on the latest version of the bill sponsored by Congressman John Conyers that was introduced in January, the new H.R. 40. So we need to get, first and foremost, the African-American member of the House of Representatives from New Jersey, get him on this bill as a co-sponsor. And then I'm urging everyone in the WBAI listening audience who is a New Jersey resident to call all your congressional representatives and to also call U.S. Senators Menendez and Booker. They are the two U.S. senators from New Jersey, and ask them to sponsor Senate version of H.R. 40, because no bill can become law unless it's passed by both houses of Congress. So we need, of course, H.R. 40, which Congressman Conyers has been introducing in the House of Representatives since 1989, I believe. But right. we also need a U.S. Senate version. So we need our U.S. senators to sponsor. And the folks who live in New York, you can ask your U.S. senators to do the same thing. In fact, let me just rephrase that and say that everybody in the WBAI listening audience should call your representatives, the members of the House of Representatives from your congressional district, call your U.S. senators, ask your House members to become co-sponsors of H.R. 40, and ask your U.S. senators to introduce a Senate version of H.R. 40.
Okay, all roads lead to the Lincoln Monument, 12 noon on the 24th. I don't know why I've been saying the 25th. I looked in my book, and I have the 24th down, but my brain is like, you know, after so many years, it slips a little bit. Anyway.
And Dr. Daniels, can I mention a couple of other things very quickly?
Because we're over time.
Today will be our 72nd Justice Monday protest. The People's Organization for Progress protests every Monday in front of the federal building in Newark, 970 Broad Street. We're there every Monday from 4:30 to 6 to protest against police brutality. So I invite everyone to come out today, Monday, June 12th, 4:30 p.m. Join us in front of the federal building, 970 Broad Street, where the U.S. Attorney's Office are. We're calling for civil rights investigations into the deaths of those killed by the police here in Jersey and draw attention to police brutality nationally. And also, Dr. Daniels, this is something for the Institute to note. This year will be the 50th anniversary of the 1967 Newark Rebellion. And so as we have done every year since the People's Organization for Progress was founded, we will be marching on July 12th to commemorate the 1967 Newark Rebellion, one of the most intense of the more than 1,000 urban uprisings that took place in this country from 1960 to 1971. So hold those dates. Join us today. Join us on June 24th and join us on July 12th.
Full agenda for the People's Organizations for Progress. Is there a website or phone number that people can call or
yes,
access?
Yes, people can contact the People's Organization for Progress directly by calling 973-801-0001, 973-801-0001. They can go to our Facebook pages, People's Organization for Progress on Facebook, and they can go to our website, www.njpop.org, and get in contact. But the best way, just give us a phone call.
All right. Old school. All right, Larry Ham, Chairman Ham, People's Organizations for Progress, appreciate you being on with this morning, and we'll continue to talk about the march in the coming weeks. Thanks much. Pretty appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Daniel.
All right, we're going to take a short break. Come back. Peter Goldberg is going to be standing by to talk to us about bail bond reform in the city of New York. We'll be right back after a brief break.
Hi, this is Randy Credico, host of Randy Credico Live on the Fly here on WBAI Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Hey, did you know you can actually donate to WBAI via text message? That's right, for as little as $10. Just text the letters WBAI to the number 41444. Keep the vision of Lewis Hill alive. Join the WBAI $10 text team. Text WBAI to the number 41444. That's all, folks.
Saul Williams.
And this is Michael Fried from Spearhead. And this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
This is Reverend Jesse Jackson of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Please call and support WBAI, non-commercial, peace and justice radio in New York.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin. Run, 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 but you sure can't hide.
All right, we're back, running a little bit behind today, but such powerful content. And of course, the discussion about Afro descendants and the assault on same our folk, our people in Colombia. A good chunk of the program today, which we hope was worthwhile. Of course, People Organization for Progress, one of the premier organizations in our area and the country, organizing around these issues for, I think Larry said, 34 years now. Incredible organization. And we'll continue to talk about the March for Reparations on the 24th next week, and also give follow-up to our conversations on the conversation about the assault on Afro descendants in Colombia as well. We're now joined by Peter Goldberg, who is the executive director of the Brooklyn Bail Bond Fund, whom I had the pleasure of meeting at a gathering for the first time in Charlotte, North Carolina. And as we exchanged cards and heard what we were doing respectively, and this issue is one in which I've taken an interest, I said, well, let's get him on the air so he can talk to us about what's going on. I assume everybody knows about it. Probably don't. So let's get more people informed about bail bond reform. Peter Goldberg, welcome to Vantage Point.
Great. Thank you so much, Ron. How are you?
I'm doing good. Let's talk about Peter Goldberg for a minute. Just got a chance to meet you in Charlotte, but don't know much about your background except you're dynamic, energetic, and visionary and all that stuff. But where does all that come from?
You're too kind. Well, I was born and raised in New York, in Manhattan. I think, like many of my contemporaries, I grew up privileged in a city that was safe and frankly knew very little about the current field that I work in. I went to college in Baltimore and then to law school. So I took the criminal justice classes and I probably knew more than most, but then I got involved in this project in 2012 when I was an attorney in New York and was helping some public defenders form a charitable bail organization. So I was doing the corporate work, and I started going to criminal court arraignments just to get an idea of how the system functioned and what was going on. And
well, hold on a minute before we get ahead of there. Where you went to Baltimore? What college in Baltimore, and what law school did you go to?
Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.
Okay. All right.
And then I lived abroad for a few years in South America, and then I went to the University of Michigan Go Blue in Ann Arbor.
Okay, I just want to fill out that background just so we know who you are.
Absolutely.
I'd like to get that kind of stuff out. You said you're new to the area, so apparently your immersion in the criminal justice class sort of sparked a certain interest, a certain sense of empathy. So how did you get? Because it's interesting because someone like Michelle Alexander, for example, talks about the fact that, you know, she was in the field, but she really had to have a kind of conversion experience on some of these larger questions. So
absolutely.
It seems that you were in a similar situation, that you kind of got drawn to this by your experiences.
Absolutely. So I wasn't even in the field. After law school, I started working at a large law firm for corporate clients. And as I said, I got involved in this project, the Brooklyn Community Bail Fund, doing some pro bono work for attorneys who wanted to form a fund. So I started going to criminal court arraignments just to see what was going on. And I was really appalled, as I think most people are, when they actually see the human cost of bail. If you go to Brooklyn Criminal Court or Manhattan, and really if you go to arraignments across the country, what you'll see is this cycle of injustice that is bail, where people are arrested, have small amounts of bail set, and then are sent to Rikers Island or whatever the jail in that jurisdiction is, simply because they aren't affluent enough to buy their own freedom effectively. And if you stick around, what you'll see is these same people come back to court and they routinely plead guilty, because that is the choice people are given. You can stay in jail and fight your case, or you can plead guilty and go home. And obviously, many people, to be back with their families, back at work, they plead guilty when they were unconstitutionally stopped and frisked, and when they're innocent. And this is a problem in New York. 45,000 people this year will be jailed for their inability to afford bail. And nationally, the number's in the millions. So this is a pervasive problem. It represents a massive injustice. It is ineffective bail. It is costly for societies and for taxpayers. Nationally, we're going to spend over $10 billion this year to house presumptively innocent people in jail cells.
You know, and the reason why I really wanted to have this show is because people kind of take this for granted. You know, somebody get arrested, you pay bail, and really it's only within the last maybe 5 years, but more recently in the last couple of years, that there's been intense interest within the criminal justice reform movement on this particular aspect. Because it just, again, it's just been seen as kind of routine. Well, you know, you go and you pay your bail and whatever. But what you're pointing out is that a lot of innocent people plead guilty just so they can, you know, they can be back with their families. Or if you don't, and I've heard instances, you know, please share narratives of people who decide to fight their case, who may well be innocent, and in most instances are, having to be in jail for long periods of time.
Yeah, it can be years. But I think it's important.
I mean, go back and say that again. Years.
It can be years. We all know of the tragic case of Khalif Browder, who was accused of stealing a backpack. His family could not afford the $10,000 bail that was set, and he spent 3 years languishing in Rikers Island, or 2 years of which he spent in solitary confinement. He was a young man, 17 years old when he went in, and he spent 3 years in. He is the rare individual who was strong enough, who had the fortitude to maintain his innocence throughout the case, and he did so because he was innocent, and he wasn't going to say he committed a crime that he did not. And tragically, when he was released, after the 3 years in, he ended up taking his own life. And this is a case where the system failed this young man at every turn. But it's important to note that even a few days in jail can have tragic consequences for individuals. Housing can be lost. Parents are ripped from their children. Jobs are lost. Individuals who are struggling are further pushed into the margins of society. So it's important that we take into account that people can spend months and years in jail, but we also have to hold on to the fact that even one day in jail because you don't have money, because you can't buy your own freedom, is too much. And it's prevalent in New York. Around 90% of people who have bail set on a misdemeanor case and have $1,000 bail set can't afford it, right? So it's not the odd person here and there. It is the vast majority, nearly everyone who has a small amount of bail set in New York cannot afford it, and presumptively innocent, they'll be jailed for weeks, right? The average is over 2 weeks for someone who can't afford a small amount of bail in New York. Right, so we really have to hold on to the fact that it's not a system where we just have to make sure that people aren't kept in for long, long periods of time where it's the odd person here and there. We have to entirely get rid of cash bail because this is a system that will always punish low-income and poor individuals, primarily people of color.
Right. So now tell us what your organization does specifically. I heard you talk about a fund and whatever, so you just sort of indicated the ultimate goal is get rid of cash bail. But what does your fund specifically do? I mean, how does it do its work?
Thank you for asking that. I realize I got ahead of myself. So we are a charitable bail organization, right? So what that means generally is we pay bail for people who can't afford it. In New York, I'd note by law we're limited to misdemeanor defendants who have bail set in amounts of $2,000 or less. Right, so what we effectively do is we get referrals from public defenders who alert us to clients who've had small amounts of bail set and who can't afford it. And we are in the jails and in courts, and we have thousands of dollars on us. And what we do is we effectively we purchase someone's freedom. You know, we'll hand over $500 and someone is freed. If we're unable to pay for that person, then that person, unfortunately, is jailed simply because they themselves are not able to buy their own freedom, right? And we operate in Brooklyn and Manhattan and Staten Island now. We've paid for nearly 2,000 of our fellow New Yorkers to date, 2,000 people who would have been jailed simply because they didn't have a few hundred dollars, right? And our clients are, simply because we pay, our clients are twice as likely to have all charges dropped, other cases totally dismissed, to not end up with a criminal record, twice as likely as folks who are kept in on low amounts of bail. So really our work shows that bail is a barrier to justice.
Right.
And we've had 95% of all of our clients make their court dates, showing that bail is ineffective. You don't need to ask people for money in order for them to make their court dates. Many will make their court dates because they're able to and they want to fight their cases. And other folks will make their court dates if you just provide some support. So we call all our clients. We try to connect them with resources that they identify they need. And we, you know, provide people an actual chance of having their case heard and dismissed rather than just having to plead guilty.
That's really amazing, amazing stuff. So now, is there also the prospect for, and I'm saying this because I actually don't know, for legislation within city council? Is this a state fair? How would this be, how would cash bond be eliminated in the city or state of New York? And I say that because I know there's this relationship between some things have to be approved by the state legislature, some things can also just be done by city council. So where are we in terms of the policy change process?
Yeah, and thank you for bringing that up because, you know, I spoke about what we do on the day-to-day, which is get people out of jail who are in prison because they can't afford bail. Our ultimate goal is the elimination of cash bail. Right, and that has to happen at the state level. bail is in New York and across the country, it is regulated by state law. So we are working with our partners, our other advocates across the city and across the state to push on Albany to lift up the life experiences of our clients and of the tens of thousands of New Yorkers who will be imprisoned this year because they can't afford bail. And we also work in New York because there are common sense solutions in the city to reduce the amount of people who are held in on cash bail while we still have it as a functioning system here. So prosecutors hold a tremendous amount of power. So someone is arrested in Brooklyn. They will be taken to a cell behind Brooklyn Criminal Court. They will wait there for 24 hours. They will then be brought in front of a judge. And at that time, a prosecutor can either request bail or she cannot, right? She can tell the defendant to come back for his next court date and allow that individual to be free pending the disposition of that person's case. And that is supposed to be the norm in this country, right? We're supposed to take the presumption of innocence seriously. Unfortunately, bail means that in New York, tens of thousands of individuals will be imprisoned simply because they're too poor to buy their own freedom, and it will be millions across the country. So we need to push on Albany to eliminate cash bail. We need to push on prosecutors in New York City to stop setting bail in amounts people can't afford. And frankly, we need to be working with our partners across the city and across the state just to bring fewer people into the system to begin with, right?
Right,
if we have a quarter of a million misdemeanor arrests in New York City this year. So that is way too many individuals just being brought into the system to begin with. They're individuals who have their poverty criminalized, who have their very existence and survival criminalized. Right? So we pay bail for individuals who are arrested for sleeping in a hallway, right? The only place they can find, for individuals who are accused of jumping a turnstile, right? They don't have $2.75 to buy their subway fare. They certainly don't have $500 to buy their own freedom. Right, so while this is a problem that can ultimately be solved, it needs to ultimately be solved in Albany through the elimination of cash bail, we also need to reconsider how we're generally treating individuals who are struggling and reconsider the very purpose and functioning of the criminal justice system.
Now, Peter, how did we get ourselves, I shouldn't say I'm not a part of it, I'm just using it collectively, how did we get into this absurd situation, and what is your sense of receptivity to making changes in it in terms of prosecutors, council members, legislators, and so forth? I mean, obviously, somebody's profiting from this, and I would suspect there is some resistance coming, some of it's attitudinally, and others is because people have a pecuniary interest in it. So what are the prospects for changes as you talk to prosecutors, as you talk, how's that going? How's that conversation moving?
Well, there's, I think, a real opportunity here in New York and across the country to move forward with common sense reforms across the criminal justice system, the various ways we bring people into it and then punish them unnecessarily, and specifically with respect to bail. So across the country, we're seeing reform. We're seeing New Jersey has, in effect, gotten rid of cash bail.
Right.
That is through the legislature. Connecticut just got rid of cash bail for misdemeanor cases. In Maryland, you're seeing the judiciary effectively get rid of cash bail. There are lawsuits going on across the country challenging the constitutionality of cash bail and winning. Right? There is an understanding at this point that What bail does is it imprisons presumptively innocent people, and that is contrary not just to our notions of justice, but to the very underpinnings of our Constitution. Right? So, and there are other positive signs across the country. You have DAs being elected who are committed to not using cash bail. You have sort of a increased understanding both on the left and the right that this is an incredibly unjust system and one that costs taxpayers billions of dollars every year. Right, so there is a real movement towards eliminating cash bail, and it's one where in New York and across the country we need to make sure that we're ever diligent here and can't settle for solutions that merely seem to address the problem but ultimately don't. So bail funds, for example, we provide a necessary intervention. We help people who are in prison because they're simply too poor to pay bail. However, we are not an ultimate solution.
Right.
Right. We should not be relied upon. Nonprofits should not be relied upon to pick and choose who gets out of jail and who stays in. What we need to do is work with our partners to push for the elimination of cash bail, because bail will always punish poor people. Right. If you have someone who has $500 bail set, and they can't afford it, well, you don't solve the problem by setting bail at $270, which is the amount they can afford, because that's money they needed to put food on the table, or it's money they needed to pay this month's rent, right? It should not be going to courts or to for-profit actors, bail bondsmen,
right,
who siphon money from low-income individuals and communities into the hands of for-profit actors.
Right. So really, I was interested, and I knew about the New Jersey case because we in IBW sort of intervened a little bit. There were some interesting civil rights leaders who came up on the wrong side of the issues that we had to try to deal with and expose and encourage and whatever. So, but in New York itself, because you didn't really mention anybody in New York. I mean, what's the attitude of the governor? What's the attitude of the speaker of the state assembly or the Senate, or is there a legislative advocate or champion who's coming forth to say, yes, we understand the problem and that we need to solve it?
Yeah, I think the governor mentioned bail reform really for the first time this year, and that is encouraging. However, it seems incredibly unlikely at this point that we're going to see anything happen this year. Former Chief Justice Lipman is a strong advocate for reform. So he has said that bail effectively functions to imprison presumptively innocent people, and we need to stop setting bail on amounts that people can't afford. Right? It's unclear who will be the champion for reform in the Senate or the Assembly at this time. But increasingly, it's an issue where you have folks on the left and the right recognizing the need for change.
Right. Well, it is certainly good, Peter, to have you and your organization on the case dealing with this issue. And I really appreciate the way in which you've helped to explain it and to, because, again, sometimes we get anesthetized and numbed to processes which are irrational and idiotic, frankly, and certainly anti-human and unjust. So your explanation and getting people to understand it, because there's so much stigma attached to, you know, and that stigma really applies largely to poor and working class people, particularly the poor, and as you said before, disproportionately on people of color. So this is certainly a worthy endeavor. And we certainly want to continue to follow it. How do people get in touch with your organization to volunteer or to support or financially or otherwise? How do people get in touch with the organization?
Thanks for asking that. They can go online to www.brooklynbailfund.org. We have information on there about how to get involved. There's an email for folks who want to be in contact directly, and I'd encourage everyone, all your listeners, to go on and to reach out and to get involved, because this is something that affects our neighbors in New York, and it's something that we all own.
Right. Well, Peter Goldberg, really appreciate you spending time with us. Glad I got a chance to meet you, and certainly an opportunity to share this vital information with our WBAI listening audience. Thanks much for being with us this morning.
Thank you, and thanks for all the work you do.
Appreciate it. Okay, all right. Well, we're going to take our final break here, and we're going to do an open forum. By that I mean, I don't want to talk about any and everything, though. I really would like to have folks call in and react to and respond to or ask questions about the three topics that we had today, the assault on Afro descendants in Columbia, which we had devoted the bulk of our show to, and then, of course, the march, the People's Organization for Progress's march on June 24th. And then finally, this bail bond reform, a very, very, I hope, informative, very practical, very meaningful, pushing forward, you know, this de-incarceration, breaking the back of mass incarceration and all this stuff that we sometimes have taken for granted, but taking it apart. And what's your reaction? What are your recommendations? What is your suggestions? What are your questions? You can call us at 347-335-0818. That's 347-335-0818. After we take this break, we're taking your calls again here on Vantage Point after this break.
Hey, this is Chaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover.
This is Saul Williams.
And this is Michael Frind from Spearhead.
And this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
This is Reverend Jesse Jackson of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Please call and support WBAI, non-commercial peace and justice radio in New York.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 put your shoulder high.
My name's Chris Hedges. I'm the author with the cartoonist Joe Sacco of Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And when Joe and I are in New York, we always listen to WBAI 99.5 or WBAI.org because we want to stay informed and not get fed the commercial lies of the corporate media.
Hoy están sufriendo por unos dementes, si por la causa del dinero aterrorizan a mi pueblo. Hoy están sufriendo los que en él están viviendo.
Renaciente nació a través de un desplazamiento en el 97 y pues nuestra letra, nuestra canción y nuestra música que va basado un poco más a la resistencia, a él contando nuestra historia de todo lo que fue ese desplazamiento hasta hoy y todas las vivencias, todo lo que realmente hemos venido viviendo desde ese tiempo hacia acá.
Luego sacan un arma y se ponen a apuntar y entonces nos dicen que tenemos que callar y si...
Okay, we're back again. Vantage Point here, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York on the Pacifica Network, and proud to be so, in collaboration with YCRadio.org, your college radio. Of course, for me, school is out. There are others who are still matriculating across the summer, but that's okay. I like the breaks. Anyway, again, people can call us at 347-335-0818. Again, 347-335-0818. I was really pleasantly surprised, and it was heartwarming at the 1199 event for Oscar Lopez Rivera. To have several people come up and say they listen to the show and they enjoy it and da-da-da-da-da-da, that was really, really affirming. In fact, a couple of them were going to snatch to be guests on the show in the next few weeks, particularly as it relates to the issues of political prisoners. So, again, this segment, we try to leave it open for, 15, 20 minutes for people to call in and share their perspectives, comments, questions on the show. I'd really like to confine it again to the areas that we discussed, though. Yeah, I'm willing to go out elsewhere, but really it's better if we kind of just talk about the issues we focused on today, the assault on Afro descendants in Colombia, People's Organizations for Progress's March for Reparations on June 24th, and this area we just covered, bail bond reform, the bail bond reform movement. I'd be interested in just seeing whether people found that informative, whether you learn something from that in terms that you may not have been aware of before. Because again, bail is kind of routine, people go and but this is really a bad thing in terms of, like you said, this year 45,000 people will I think you said 45,000 this year dealing with the whole question of misdemeanors, maybe it was even more than that, but it's a huge number. And people who, many of them just sort of plead guilty, even though they're not guilty, just so they can get home because they can't afford it. And others who stay in jail for weeks, and if not years, not a good thing. So you can call us again. The number is 347-335-0818 here on Vantage Point to get your voice into the conversation. I think we have a caller on. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Good morning, Dr. Daniels. Thank you for your show.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. The subject I'd like to weigh in on very quickly is the issue of the assault upon Afro descendants in various parts of Latin America and indeed all over the world. And I think my primary point with regard to the vicious attacks that Afro descendant and Afro diasporas are subjected to has to do with the need for a strong international vocalization around these atrocities. In addition to the Afro-Colombian situation, I wanted to call attention to the recent immunization of a young man in Venezuela. He was doused with gasoline and set on fire in the ongoing standoff between the Chavistas versus the reactionaries there, and of course we are well aware of the Haitian assaults by Dominicans who have recently engaged in their own lynchings of Haitian individuals. And in fact, toward that point, I'd like to suggest that we really put Espiot on point and force him to make some type of a statement, because I understand where there have been instances where he has been backed up on that issue, at the same time trying to encourage the fact that Trump is illegal in what he's trying to do with immigrants, at the same time not being able to back down on what Dominicans are doing toward the Haitian immigrants. So just to wrap it all up, I know you have a limited amount of time, I think that this whole vicious and aggressive barbaric assault on Afro-descendant people has to be couched in new terminology, and it has to be based around pure barbarity of people who gain their advantage on literally eating people of color. And don't think that you're where you are because you're, better, superior. No, the only thing you're superior in is your ability to to just assault and decimate other populations. And I think if we change the vocabulary, that would do something to begin to put it in its proper context, because these are not fair battles by any stretch of the imagination. So I'm just going to leave it there and let somebody else take it further. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. Actually, I had hoped to get a chance to speak with Congressman Esmionat yesterday, because he was there for the a very, very exciting and very powerful breakfast that was organized by Stella Vasquez, the executive vice president of 1199 SEIU, for Oscar Lopez Rivera. There were a number of key people there, but he had to leave because I very much want to engage him. He has petitioned to be a part of the Congressional Black Caucus, thereby declaring himself an Afro-descendant, which I think is potentially a positive thing. I don't know where the Congressional Black Caucus stands on that. I would be in favor of him being a part of it, because there are Afro-descendants. In fact, yesterday on CNN, a very, very interesting program that Rosa Clemente was a part of about Puerto Rico that was quite interesting in dealing with Afro-descendants in Puerto Rico and whatever. But he does need to be on point on this issue, because the treatment of Haitians, of Dominicans, of Haitian ancestry, Haitian descent, is really egregious. I mean, egregious does not even begin to talk about how horrifically they are treated. And then Haitians who go over to work in the sugar fields and so forth, also brutally treated. And that really needs to come to an end. And we really need, and there are Dominicans who are progressives who have come to the forefront and address this issue. And we need to continue to deal with it. And frankly, again, one of the things I've talked about is economic sanctions. I'm a strong believer in economic sanctions. You know, black people go, and they're friends too. But I'm just saying, just black people. How many people, you know, go to the Dominican Republic to vacation? It is a great vacation place, right? But, well, all right, you want to stop what's happening to Haitians? You know, we call a boycott and sanctions and vacations in the Dominican Republic, and you watch how quickly the tune changes. I guarantee you, it's about our ability to aggregate ourselves and organize around a specific target like that and get it done. And that sends signals everywhere about our willingness, you know, to sacrifice and commit in order to achieve objectives. Let's go down to another caller. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Good morning, Dr. Daniels. Thank you for your program.
Good morning.
Hello?
Yeah, good morning. You're on.
Good morning. Yes, so I'm calling to comment on the bail bond. And I'm saying it's a good idea that there is a program trying to eliminate or decrease bail bonds, but I think eliminating it would be the best solution, and probably a system where, okay, they did commit some misdemeanor, maybe just a small summons, but not in the, you know, depth that it is right now, that is a criminal, it's a crime for sleeping in the subway or small things like that. So, you know, I think something like that would be better than trying to just pay people's bonds as a way to help. Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening. I'm just listening to your
comments. Yeah, and also just to ask you if you are aware of missing children in Washington, if that's anything you've heard of, if there can be some kind of program about that. I was looking online about so many thousands of kids that's coming up missing in Washington, and seems no one knows where they are. So, and I'd like to see a program on that, or if you've heard anything about it, or if you can get someone to comment or have a program on that.
We'll look into that. I'm sure our sister station, WPFW, has dealt with that. So I'll make an inquiry, and we're certainly willing to air a program about that. And I'm glad you reminded me, because it was a hot topic for a week or two, and then all of a sudden it kind of disappeared from the, off of the public agenda. So I'm glad you reminded me. Okay, thanks much for your call. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Okay, thank you.
All right. Okay. Others can call 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818 Yes, somebody jumping over the turnstile. Some of these, you know, this is a part of this quality of life zero tolerance policy. Now, do you want somebody to jump over? No, but I mean, why should that be an offense that requires bail bond? I mean, why? I mean, some of this stuff is maybe you go to the station, you get a lecture, and you're released or something. I mean, come on. I mean, this penchant for criminalizing people, and it's the poor, it's working people, and it's in situations where, frankly, there is no economic justice in this society for people at the bottom. There's no economic justice for people below. There's an article yesterday, the top, they said 1%, the top below the bottom four-fifths. No economic justice to speak of. And so I always didn't like this idea. The squeegee people, the people who are, you know, and what is that, four-card Molly, a three-card Molly, and all that. Well, these are things that may be inconveniences and so forth, but why should we be criminalizing people for this kind of behavior? So I really strongly support this bail bond reform effort and the idea to eliminate it. We need to start looking at people differently, start looking at people as human beings as opposed to the kind of behavior that we have. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Me?
Yes, you're on.
Okay. I just wanted to ask, like, what's going on over there that you mentioned about in Colombia? Was that something that Cuba used to handle? Like, they would come to the aid of a situation like that?
Well, Cuba helped to negotiate, frankly, an end to the Civil War. It took years and years and years of negotiations. So Cuba is, you know, there are nations in the hemisphere, Cuba at the lead of it, who are, of course, interfacing with the Colombian government and speaking out about doing the right thing. And again, their greatest contribution was to actually negotiate this end of the conflict. Now, the Afro descendants had to fight to get a seat at the table and to get included in that agreement, because they were getting caught in a crossfire from various different sides, both in terms of the conflict itself, the fact that they're positioned and situated on territory or that's valuable. So they're getting ripped various different ways. In this particular instance, one of the questions becomes the issue of the role of the U.S. government. And that's why we're saying that we need to hear, to find out some of the U.S. corporations that are involved. Then we can target them, because Cuba doesn't have corporations. And they certainly don't have corporations.
No, but I'm not saying they have corporations. They went to Africa a couple of times, right?
And yeah, but they're not going to send troops to Colombia. They
played
their role.
They did. I'm not saying what they're going to do. I'm just trying to make a connection on their role in the past and helping people, you know.
Yeah, I've already answered that. Yes, they are playing a role diplomatically, pressuring and suggesting to Colombia they should do the right thing. And their greatest contribution has been to help negotiate the peace settlement. Years and years and years, this has been a struggle that needed to be resolved. The Cubans helped resolve it. The people on the ground who are pressuring to take the people's land are U.S.-based corporations. We can influence that by identifying U.S. corporations who are doing that, exposing them, and potentially exacting economic sanctions against them. That is what I was trying to get to in terms of the corporation, the greatest contribution that we may be able to do. The Cubans are doing their part. Now it's on black people in this country, our allies and friends from unions, faith organizations, progressive organizations, to do their part in terms of putting greater pressure on the Colombian government to honor agreements that it's already said, already inked, that they very often have been defunct on or haven't implemented. Okay?
Thank you.
All right, thank you much. Really appreciate it. Others can call at 347-335-0818, 347-335-0818. We are going to report on that next week. We'll get a list of who signed on to the bill. Our friend, Congresswoman Yvette Clark's name was mentioned, is not having signed on to the letter, and I'm sure that there's some reason that some of it's just a matter of that it didn't get to the staff person or whatever. Congressman Gregory Meeks, who is on the committee that oversees hemispheric work, and with whom I do have a relationship as well, I've actually discussed this with him and have sent information to his chief of staff about this, and so I'm delighted that he has signed on to this letter as well. But we were certainly going to get the information out so people will know who's on and who's not. We're also going to do the same thing with H.R. 40, the reparations remedy bill, nationally, which Congressional Black Caucus members are on and which ones are not, so people can also see that. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes, good morning. I'm not sure, but I think I heard on VAI he was talking about the bail situation in Jersey.
Yes.
Where they were saying that they're actually going back in people's history to, like, maybe an offense they had when they were, like, 15 to deny them bail or to, you know, just keep them locked up. Do you have any information on that?
Well, I don't have the specifics of what happened in New Jersey. New Jersey is one of the states that has voted to significantly reform the bail bond system. Now, I don't have the specifics of that. I'm willing to check on it, certainly. But it may only be confined to people with misdemeanors, because a lot of the people who are being locked up and who are in jail are misdemeanors. I mean, on stuff that really, you know, and like you say, $500 bail, $1,000 bail for a misdemeanor. And the vast majority of these people are innocent. The fact that the basis of U.S. law is the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. Well, you set the bail at a certain level, you know, you are presumed guilty. You know, and this is supposed to be on the threat to escape and run away and all that. But the fact of the matter is there's an industry, the bail bond industry, that thrives on this. And in New Jersey, I know for a fact, the bail bond industry was fiercely opposed to any reforms. And unfortunately, to some civil rights organizations, one in particular, who was getting contributions from that industry, sent one of its spokespersons up to speak against bail bond reform, which is really ridiculous. I mean, given the fact that, you know, I mean, most of the people
when I was listening, they were saying something about that they were using past offenses, even if they were, like, you know, when they were 15 and the guy might be 30 now, they would use his past offense when he was 15 to even deny the bail, you know, at for his minor offense that he committed.
Well, that I don't remember us necessarily discussing that, but the important point is that New Jersey has been at the forefront of bail bond reform. That is to say that finding ways in which either minimizing bail bond the people have to pay and making it much less oppressive, if not eliminating it altogether. And I won't say eliminating, because I actually don't know for a fact that that's what's happened, but I will check on it and try to get a report for you next week.
One more thing in reference to the reparations. Is it true, or can you speak on a little bit about the fact that it would be easier for African people to get reparations when they identify themselves as African people as opposed to Black or African-American or something like that, because, you know, they're saying that there's no Black country, but if you say you're an African, then you align yourself with the African continent with what happened to African people all over the world, and that would make it a little bit more, bolster up a little bit more for you to be able to secure the reparations.
Yeah, well,
I'll hang up and listen, because I know a lot of people have questions. I'd like you to talk on that if you can, brother.
Right, well, thank you. Appreciate your call. Make a quick comment on that. I think more than how we are defined is the organized political will and muscle that we put behind the demand. If we say we're Blacks from Africa, whether we say African, people of African descent, or if we say African, frankly, more than anything else, it is, first of all, persuading a critical mass of Black people, a much larger number of Black people, in the veracity of the claim, that it's a righteous claim. And that, as Larry Hamm pointed out, it has nothing to do with with the probability of achievement. That has nothing to do with it. If it's the right thing to do, it's the right thing to do. And once you put your mind to acknowledging it's the right thing to do, the improbable may become possible. So I don't really think it's much a matter of whether we align ourselves with Africa or not. But here's what works. The fact that the 15 nations of the Caribbean have come together and they are demanding reparations for native genocide and African enslavement of the former colonial powers, that was a major statement that gave impetus and encouragement to not only the reparations movement in this country, but all over the world. Because now it's the activist work is important, but now you have actual governments, actual nations standing up. So it's those kinds of things that will be most powerful. And again, I also think that, you know, being able to leverage our economic power behind the demand is another way of being maximally effective. So we appreciate all the calls that have come in today, and next week we're going to try to report back on some of the things we talked about this week. I can tell you that next week one of the things we're going to talk about is this debate about the N-word, because Mayor, I forget the guy now, real talk with my Mayor, precipitated a debate again about the N-word. And so we're going to have some conversations about that as well. So again, this is the website, ibw21.org, to keep up to the work of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And equally, if not most importantly, on WBAI, go to givetowbai.org and become a WBAI buddy. We really want to keep WBAI strong and growing and more vital. And so that's one of the things we always ask you to do. And you only have to contribute $10 a month, become a sustaining contributor as a WBAI buddy. Please do that. Please do that. Support this effort. 58 years on the airways only because of people like you out there making the decision that it's so important to do so. So thank you again for listening. This is, again, the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president, Institute of Blackwell 21st Century, and distinguished lecturer at York College, City University of New York, saying we'll see you again next week on Vantage Point.
Hi, my name is Michael G. Haskins, and I'm one of the hosts of The Morning Show, which airs Monday through Friday, 6 to 8 a.m. on this station. WBAI is listener-supported, commercial-free, resistance radio, challenging norms and defying them. Let's break down what that means. It means that no clandestine corporate entity tells me how to do my show. You better believe that. It means that you, the listener, and the diverse WBAI community have a voice which reverberates across the tri-state area. You drive this station, so fuel us. Donate by visiting givetowbai.org or pledge right now from your smartphone by texting the letters WBAI to 41444. And thank you for your support.
If you've ever cut your grass and found a car, you might be a redneck.
Did you know that WBAI has a car donation program? Another way to support this station is by donating a vehicle, a car, a truck, RV, or even a boat. To donate a vehicle in support of WBAI, call us at 1-866-WBAI-CAR. That's 1-866-922-4227. WBAI's partners will take all of your information and take care of the details. You can also visit WBAI.org and click on the Ways to Donate banner for more information. Again, that number is 1-866-WBAI-CAR. And then you can leave the lawn ornaments to Foxworthy and friends.
This is Brenna Keeley from Make Music New York, inviting WBAI listeners to participate in the 11th annual Make Music New York celebration on Wednesday, June 21st. Every year in the summer solstice, we fill all five boroughs with free outdoor concerts, and we want you to join the fun. For more information on how to participate, either as a performer or as a venue, go to makemusicny.org.
And don't forget to tune in Fridays at 2 for Making Music with Jordan McLean here on 99.5 WBAI and WBAI.org.
That'll wrap up the morning's programming here on WBAI. Thank you so much for tuning in. And as you've been hearing, folks are asking you to become sustaining members to this commercial-free and listener-sponsored community radio station. Visit the website WBAI.org. You can even text your contribution to WBAI. You can do so by texting the letters WBAI to the number 41444. Or just visit our website, WBAI.org. Become a sustaining member. It is 12 noon.